Historian Robert Dalek is an expert on U.S. presidents. He's a prolific author who's written about many of them, including FDR, JFK, LBJ, Nixon, Reagan, and Truman, among others. His latest book, officially released this week, continues that tradition.
It's called Camelot's Court, Inside the Kennedy White House, and it's an up-close look at the elite group of advisors in the John F. Kennedy administration, a circle of men, and they were all men, who collectively earned the nickname the best and the brightest. With us from Argo Studios in New York City to talk about his book is Robert Dalek. Mr. Dalek, welcome back to Radio Boston.
My pleasure.
And, you know, as you do know, what many people often forget or don't know is that that quote, the best and the brightest, which I believe was coined by David Halberstam for his well-known book, was used somewhat ironically, you know, to explain how these group of supposedly smart guys got us mired deep in Vietnam. On the other hand, one of the Ted Sorensen, who was JFK's speechwriter and trusted aide, called that group the Ministry of Talent, which I believe was said in earnest. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. And Halberstam, of course, was also quite on the mark, very much on the mark, by describing them as the best and the brightest, but with a sense of the irony, as you've just said, because, you know, Kennedy became very skeptical of many of these advisors, especially on Vietnam. But it began with the Bay of Pigs. After the failure there, he said, "How could I have been so stupid?" And he was convinced after that he should not simply follow their advice. And he went to Paris, where he met with Charles de Gaulle. And de Gaulle said to him, "You know, you must listen to people who are around you, the wise, sensible, intelligent advisors that you've appointed to high office, that you've selected. But then you have to make up your own mind." And Kennedy remembered what Harry Truman said, "The buck stops here." And that time forward, I think he was very skeptical of what advisors were telling him. Not that he discounted it. He didn't throw it out. But he was discriminating. And that was particularly true during the Cuban Missile Crisis, when his military advisors were urging him to bomb, invade. In fact, I published an article in The Atlantic called JFK versus the Joint Chiefs, because he had something of an ongoing war with them. They were so militant, so inclined to rely on their nuclear weapons, which gave them a huge advantage in any potential conflict they might have with the Soviet Union or any communist country. And so he saw this as the ultimate failure if we had to use nuclear weapons. And at one point he said to some young woman privately, he said, "I'd rather my kids be red than dead." He never could have said that in public, because he would have been ripped apart by conservatives in the country.
But that's
what he believed.
That skepticism you're talking about came over time. So at least initially, Kennedy had great faith in his advisors, people like Robert McNamara and McGeorge Bundy and Dean Rusk. You know, he realized that he lacked experience in international affairs, at least as much as they had, and he helped assemble this group of people. Give us a little overview of how similar they were ideologically, you know, age-wise, or how diverse or not diverse was this team of men?
Well, I think the commonality was that they were all highly intelligent, and that was of tremendous importance to him. But he wanted also to have people who were exceptionally accomplished. And so when he found Robert McNamara, who had become the president of the Ford Motor Company, a man in his early 40s, he was greatly impressed with that and had the conviction or the belief that McNamara could manage this impossible agency called the Defense Department. When he turned to Dean Rusk to be Secretary of State, Rusk was also a highly accomplished and highly intelligent official. Of course, his national security advisor was McGeorge Bundy, the youngest dean of the Harvard faculty in the history of that university. So intelligence was at the center of all this. They were also, politically, they were a very mixed group, because McNamara and Bundy were both Republicans. And, of course, we have to remember that Kennedy won that election in 1960 by 118,000 votes. He barely squeaked through. And so he was convinced that he had to have a kind of bipartisan administration. And to begin with, he reappointed J. Edgar Hoover as the head of the FBI and Alan Dulles, another Republican, as head of the CIA. And then he brought in Bundy and brought in McNamara, who were centrist, moderate Republicans, but nevertheless, they were from the other side of the aisle. So he was mindful of the politics and mindful of their intelligence. But the most important advisor to him was, of course, his brother, Robert Kennedy.
Sure.
And there was a lot of controversy about appointing Bobby Kennedy as Attorney General. And Kennedy said, look, I don't know any of these other fellows. I need somebody I can put my feet up with and talk candidly to.
And in fact, didn't his dad advise him that your closest relatives should be the people you trust the most?
Well, that's true. But, you know, there was this fiction that his father forced him into appointing Bobby as Attorney General. That was just a kind of political cover for the fact that he was going to make his brother Attorney General. And Bobby, the thing we'll never have are the many, many private conversations that Jack and Bobby had. They're not recorded. They're not written down. And we can detect some of this by watching and listening to and reading what Bobby Kennedy said during some of the most crucial meetings they had, for example, during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Because my guess is that Jack and Bobby talked before the meeting convened, and then Bobby would take up the cudgels, and especially when he would be dealing with the Joint Chiefs, who, as I said a few minutes ago, the president was so, so skeptical about them. But one has to also understand those Joint Chiefs came out of World War II, and they believed in the idea that if you got into a total war, you bombed your enemy, your adversary, back to the Stone Age. You see, that's what they had done with Germany, with Japan. And, of course, there is, in my book, a discussion of the fact that at the end of the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy, who had held the chiefs at arm's length throughout this crisis, because he didn't want to follow their lead. He didn't want to listen to this advice counseling him to bomb and invade. At the end of the missile crisis, he calls them in to have a meeting with them, and that one of them says to him, Mr. President, you've been had. Khrushchev is hiding the missiles in caves. Well, the White House leaks this to the press, and Khrushchev hears about it, reads it, and he writes Kennedy saying, I don't live in the caveman age. In essence, I'm no caveman. And the chiefs say to him, you have to be prepared still to invade and bomb. And Kennedy gives them leeway to go ahead and make plans. Why not? They're always making contingency plans. Part of the plan is to consider using nuclear weapons against Cuba. And what's so astonishing is that they talk about how collateral damage could be limited. Well, if they had dropped the one megaton nuclear bomb on Cuba, it would have turned the island into a pile of rubble. And just imagine what it would have done to the south coast of Florida.
You know, Robert Dallek, there have been very few sort of major media outlets that reviewed your book yet, only because it's just becoming available. But I noticed that in the online reviews on places like Amazon and Goodreads, where general readers can weigh in, one common theme is that a lot of the ground you write about has been covered before. And some people have said they wish the book expanded on the territory that has already been covered, and they weren't sure it did. I'm wondering what you think you've added here, or in what way you think you put your signature stamp or voice on this part of the Kennedy canon?
Well, you know, there was a great Dutch historian, Peter Gale, who once said, history is argument without end. And there is a debate among historians about the fact that Kennedy enjoys phenomenal popularity with the public. There was a poll not long ago asking Americans to assess the last nine presidents from Kennedy to George W. Bush. And Kennedy came out on top with an 85% approval rating. The only one within hailing distance of him was Ronald Reagan with 74%. Now, the great bulk, I would say, of professional historians simply would not sign on to that. They see Kennedy as maybe an average president, but maybe not even that, because, after all, he was there for only 1,000 days, the seventh briefest presidency in American history. So I went back to look at this. I began this new book by saying, historians live by the proposition you write a book to forget a subject. But Kennedy kept sort of coming back into focus for me. Why? Because I couldn't quite understand why the public was so taken with him, so enamored, and I wanted to revisit all these great foreign policy crises which were at the center of his presidential administration. And I came away with deepened respect for the man, with the feeling that he really saved this country from a nuclear war, not just in that Cuban Missile Crisis, but by getting that nuclear test ban treaty, by reining in those joint chiefs, and that also I was more respectful of him for what he achieved in putting that civil rights bill before the Congress in June of 1963. I didn't quite take that in my initial studies, but you know, he was taking a dangerous political position because he could have been defeated in the South. It had provided the margin of victory for him in 1960. And, you know, as we watch this current crisis in the country, where is political courage, you see? Kennedy, of course, wrote that famous book about political courage. And I think in going back and rereading these accounts of what they did and looking more closely at these crises, I came away with a stronger impression of him as a more than average president, a significant president, I would say. Not a great president, but a significant one. And I think that sort of separates me from lots of other historians who have not felt that way about him.
In the time we have left with you, I'm glad you brought up the modern-day situation going on with President Obama, because as you look at what's happening with the Obama White House, not just the immediate showdown over the government shutdown and the debt ceiling, but the president sort of framing this as a major conflict between the executive and legislative branches, and his unwillingness to, as he says, not allow Republicans to use something like the debt ceiling as a weapon of governmental mass destruction. What do you think as you watch this?
Well, what I think of is a conversation I had with him. I've had dinner with him four times. He likes to talk to presidential historians. And at one of these dinners, he complained about people in the Congress. And so I said to him, "Well, Mr. President, I guess you know what Mark Twain said about congressmen." He shook his head. And I told him, "Mark Twain said, suppose you're a congressman, and suppose you're an idiot, but I repeat myself." And I suspect currently, he's much more inclined to agree with that proposition.
That's Robert Dalek. He's an author and presidential historian. His latest book of many is Camelot's Court, Inside the Kennedy White House. Robert Dalek, thank you so much for talking with us again on Radio Boston.
My pleasure.
And that's it for today. You can always post comments about anything you hear on our program at radioboston.org. Our program is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.